So the Dhamma for today is called the Five Powers. And they're not, of course, the only five powers. There are many different kinds of power. There's, for example, physical power, mental power. There's unwholesome power, wholesome power. Here we're talking specifically about mental power, and specifically, of course, about wholesome mental power. So the difference, physical power is something that is easy to see and relatively easy to develop, or the method of development is easily understood. But mental power is considered superior. Of course, Buddhism isn't interested in physical power because of the dangers and the limitations of physical power. Physical power can be used over others. Someone can exert physical power over another person. Same can be said with mental power, but physical power doesn't have the same power over oneself. One can have great physical power, that means power of the body, or it can also mean other physical types of power, money, fame, authority, that sort of thing. Even the ability to manipulate people with speech or with actions. But of course none of this has the same power over oneself. Those kinds of physical power can't help one to find peace, happiness. One can have a great amount of physical authority. One can be rich, powerful, and still be completely discontent and unhappy, mentally, spiritually, emotionally. So mental power is considered superior, and of course, obviously, much more of the focus of the Buddha's teaching. Unwholesome power versus wholesome power. Obviously, we're not interested in cultivating unwholesome power, but what it might be and the way it works is important to understand, because it's certainly possible for us to develop and to have to tackle and approach these things in Buddhism. Obviously, we have to deal with the unwholesome power or the power of unwholesomeness. This is the power of things like greed, anger, delusion. They can be, to some extent, powerful. They pale in comparison to the power of wholesomeness. But there is a great power of greed. The real distinction between wholesome power and unwholesome power is that unwholesome power, again, is to one's detriment, but the meaning is it more has power over oneself rather than give one power. So you might think that something like anger will give you great power, or you might think that what we call delusion gives you power, but you think of that as things like pride and arrogance. I mean, maybe it's hard to, I don't think people would articulate it that way, but they would. But there are certainly people who feel like their authority over others, their ability to oppress others out of a sense of being better than them, no? Where parents have exert power over their children, trying to control them, and where bosses and husbands will often try to exert power over their wives, and wives over their husbands through argument and manipulation and so on. But these kinds of power, what happens is that over time, the power of greed that seems to have great power in the beginning to give you what you want. It seems like you are in great power when you chase after the things that you want. There's power in that. What's the power? The power to get what you want. But obviously we see through the Buddha's teaching, through our practice of the Buddha's teaching, that it ends up being the opposite, where these things have incredible power over us. They drag us and keep us bound to the objects of our desire, the sights and sounds and smells and tastes, feelings, and even the ideas. When we have ambitions or goals in life, they can keep us tied to those things, keep us in debt and bound to great stress and suffering as we strive to achieve our goals and get what we want and so on. Anger as well, obviously, is a great power, but it's the power that we initially seem to think we have over it or through it in order to, again, not get what we want this time, but remove what we don't want, change what we don't like, destroy what we loathe. This leads us to think that we have some power over, but this power eventually becomes, again, power over us, where the anger controls us, where we're unable to find peace and happiness, we're unable even to find harmony with others, obviously, because anger is not something that lends itself to harmony, that lends itself to peace in society. Anger is what lends itself to cruelty and ill will and disharmony, obviously. So the problem is that these, of course, become habitual and they become our answer to things. They were triggered by sights and sounds and smells and so on that we like or dislike. And though we think we are the master of these things, we learn quite quickly that we're in fact the slave, where we are under the power of these emotions, having to chase after what we want and being upset by what we don't like or don't want. And of course, delusion, our arrogance, our conceit, becomes a dominating power in our lives. We are unable to let go, we're unable to experience reality, we're unable to be objective because we're constantly trying to fix and control. We worry, we doubt, we're unable to find true confidence and true power because we're constantly judging and trying to fix. We're not in a position where we can experience, as we do in mindfulness meditation, reality just as it is. We're not able to be here now, as they say. We're instead always, what if it was like this, or how could it be like this, or what can I do to make it like that? Even with our meditation practice, we can see how we're trying to fix and control and change things rather than just trying to see them and learn to let go and learn to just be and be at peace. So this is the power of unwholesomeness, and it helps us understand the difference between wholesomeness and unwholesomeness. It helps us to see the distinction of what might actually be wholesome, and helps us to identify the things that the five powers and all the good qualities that we're developing are meant to overcome, meant to free us from. So the five powers that are mental wholesome powers are saddha, confidence, virya, energy, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, concentration, and panya, wisdom. These five are also the five indriya, or we translate as faculties, but the word indriya means something like, again, that which controls, or that which is lord of, or the, in control of, in charge of. So the word indriya is used for various non-overlapping spheres of influence, like the eye faculty. Everything you see is controlled by the eye faculty. In other words, you can't see with your ear faculty, you can't hear sights and you can't see sounds. So they're non-overlapping, they're separate. And that's the idea with the five faculties. Everyone has the five indriya. Saddha, we all have confidence to some level. Virya, we all have effort or energy. Sati, we all have mindfulness from time to time. Samadhi, we have differing levels of concentration. And panya, we have some level of wisdom, or low level of wisdom or high level of wisdom, but we have some. That's what indriya is. Bala is the strength. When you cultivate, the idea is, the teaching is, when you cultivate and mature the faculties, they become power, they become bala, or strength or power. And so that's what we're focusing on today, is these powers. The other thing that we can say about them, in terms of turning the indriya into bala, or the faculties into powers, is that there's the possibility and there's the potential to cultivate these to your detriment. That these are not, even putting aside the detriment of unwholesome power, or the power of greed and anger and delusion, Any of these five can increase your capacity to perform unwholesomeness if not cultivated properly. So the idea here is it follows this idea of power being dangerous. Power is dangerous, and these five are not an exception. Well, there is one exception, we'll talk about that. But generally speaking, mental power, they're called powers not because they're always going to lead to freedom from suffering, but they're called powers because they make the mind strong. So for example, saddha, we have confidence, but confidence can be cultivated to your detriment if it's not cultivated correctly. Mostly if it's cultivated allowing for greed, allowing for anger, allowing for delusion. Obviously we know others or we ourselves have fallen victim to being overconfident. When you're sure of yourself and turn out to be wrong, confidence can lead you to be gullible if you believe anything. And we as human beings are susceptible to this by our very nature. We're constantly being manipulated by our own defilements of greed or anger, delusion, rationalizing why we should chase after this or why we should continue to indulge in this or that, why we should be angry, we deserve to be angry, why it's right to be angry. So we can have this kind of confidence and therefore we understand that there is limits and there are dangers involved in the outright unchecked cultivation of any of the mental faculties. Effort. Some people cultivate great amounts of effort, but you can have effort in doing unwholesomeness, obviously. Anger takes a lot of effort. You end up being tired afterwards and it doesn't end up being very powerful at all, but you can develop effort in for greed, chasing after the things that you want. It requires a lot of effort to chase after the things you want. There's a lot of effort put into delusion, greed, arrogance, conceit, even worry, how much effort you can cultivate to worry and end up spending all this effort. Concentration. You can develop great concentration, being very fixed on unwholesomeness. If you simply cultivate concentration. This is why, or all of these are examples of why meditation has to be cultivated with a teacher and why we make a distinction between the practice of mindfulness or the practice of vipassana and the practice of samatha. Even the practice of proper meditation based on a concept, based on a mental projection or something that you create in the mind, because it's not based on actual experience, it won't allow you to necessarily see immediately any unwholesomeness that crops up. There are cases of people who practice samatha meditation, focusing on a concept or an idea or a light or a crystal or a candle flame or something, that they will actually end up cultivating psychosis or temporary insanity or getting lost in paranoia and fear and all sorts of unwholesome habits of mind because of its inability to let go or to free one, to overcome the greed, the anger, and the delusion. That the greed can sneak in where you like what you see and you want to see more and want to see something better constantly. So greed can develop. Anger can also develop, delusion can also develop. Delusion is a big one because you begin to think this is enlightenment or this is the path to enlightenment, whatever you see, whatever you experience. Or it's quite common for people to think that good experiences that they obtain are true enlightenment. So there's greed involved, there's also delusion involved. It's very common for meditators to think they are enlightened because of something that is totally unrelated to enlightenment, some pleasant experience, some calm experience, or some special experience. Maybe they can hear things far away or see things far away. Incredibly powerful, but also problematic and potentially dangerous. Wisdom as well. Wisdom, it's hard to say, is truly dangerous because of the meaning of the word wisdom. But technically speaking, by wisdom, we just mean knowledge or understanding. So knowledge and understanding is a broad category. You can have knowledge that is intellectual. You can have understanding that is based on logic. And of course, logic can be wrong. Logic can be logical, but still not in accordance with reality. For something to be true wisdom in Buddhism and truly powerful, it has to be based on experience. This is the problem you see often where people have studied the Buddha's teaching, studied the commentaries, studied the meditation manuals. There are now manuals on how to teach this practice that deal with the stages of knowledge and the various intricacies. But learning about these things, studying them, can actually to be one's great detriment. It's often thought that it will actually block you from progressing if you know about these things and if you think about these things, because rather than practicing mindfulness, you're instead just engaging in intellectual pursuit. And of course, it leads to doubt, wondering if you're in this stage or that stage. It leads to worry, leads to greed, it leads to even aversion when you feel sad or feel like you're not where you should be. It can lead to boredom, it can lead to discontent with the practice when it's not giving you what you think you should gain, and so on. So these four you have to be careful with. The only one you don't really have to be concerned with is mindfulness, and that's because mindfulness is called the controlling faculty or the balancing faculty. It keeps confidence from outpacing wisdom. So if you have lots of confidence but not enough wisdom, again, you're gullible and you just believe anything. You believe what you think, your own ideas. You believe what someone else tells you. You believe that what you see is the way to enlightenment and so on, lacking in wisdom. It prevents wisdom from outpacing confidence. So if you have so much intellectual knowledge, then you doubt and you're not sure and you're confused. And you're always wondering if you're there or where you are, because you don't have the confidence that would come from being mindful. Effort and concentration, mindfulness again allows them to keep pace so you don't have too much energy, too much effort, pushing too hard, exerting yourself too hard. So energy is a common one for many meditators. Something that you'll find, you gain energy with things like walking meditation. I remember we once spent the whole night in walking back and forth. We weren't really being all that mindful, but boy, did we have a lot of energy. There were two or three of us doing walking from sundown to sunrise. When I told my teacher about it, he said, "Oh, that's just exercise. There's nothing to that." With mindfulness, you have to be present. It's not about just develop. You know, the most important is to be mindful. Just developing effort is not great. We have the story, similar story with Ananda, who wasn't doing it for exercise, but was actually practicing walking meditation all night. And it was great that he was intent to practice all night. He was totally determined, completely determined to become enlightened. But because he was only practicing walking meditation, he became too energetic, too excited, and there was an imbalance of the faculties. And so as a result, he realized this, he stepped back and reflected, and considered that he should have to change his posture. And so instead of going to sitting, he went more extreme and went to lying down, which normally he wouldn't want to do because he would think he would fall asleep. But here, he had been walking all night, and because of all that walking, he had to change. And as he was lying down, his head hadn't touched the pillow, but his feet had left the floor. And that's interesting because they say he wasn't lying down, he wasn't sitting, he wasn't standing. He's the only example we have of someone becoming enlightened in none of the four postures. But before his head hit the pillow, he became an arahant, just by the change in posture. The balancing of the faculties, well, partly because he stepped back, but more importantly because he was able to be more mindful. He wasn't so determined, so obsessed with exerting energy, effort in the walking meditation. Concentration, if you have a lot of concentration, this is why you're drowsy and falling asleep. Sometimes it can be good to stand up or do walking meditation. Most important is that we cultivate mindfulness. The true path to cultivating power, that all five of these should become powerful, is you have confidence in mindfulness, or the confidence is that which allows you to be mindful. And so normal confidence becomes a power as you practice mindfulness and see the benefits of it. When you start to realize for yourself that the mindfulness of the present moment in walking and in sitting brings you benefit. As you start to note, as you find yourself catching and noting the body, the feelings, the thoughts, and the hindrances and so on, as you see that it works, obviously you gain consciousness. You see that it's beneficial and you start to understand in what way is it beneficial and what is it leading to, how it's leading you to be present, to be objective, to let go of your judgments and your partialities and so on, and to be free from the suffering that comes from defilements. Effort is the effort to be mindful. You'll know you have a powerful effort when you're able to be mindful moment after moment, where you're not distracted, not caught off guard, not drifting off into daydreams or so on, when you are sharp and when you are aware of each foot moving. Of course, in the beginning it's not like that and you can't force yourself to be that way. But you'll see as you practice, it becomes stronger and stronger and you're able to repeatedly bring the mind back to the present moment, aware of the rising, aware of the falling, aware of every pain and every thought and every emotion and so on, seeing and hearing. When it gets to the point where you're able to continuously catch everything, you'll know you have right effort and also right concentration. The right concentration is the concentration that is fixed, so fixed not on one single object, which would be tranquility meditation, but fixed on each object simply as it is. When you're able to catch the experience and be with the experience without losing it or judging it or in any way being distracted from the ordinary experience, you'll know you have strong concentration. When moment after moment you're able to be aware actually of the experience, so it's not just a word in your head where you're saying stepping right, stepping left, but you're actually aware, yes, this is stepping right, this is stepping left. That's right concentration. That's concentration that is a power. It is powerful. And the power of wisdom, again, as I said, is the wisdom that sees the experience for what it is. It's wisdom, knowledge in the sense of knowing because you see, or knowing for yourself. And so we often prefer the word seeing. This is where the word vipassana comes from, means seeing clearly, rather than focusing on the word wisdom because of how it can be misunderstood as a mental understanding. We use the word vipassana to replace the word panya because it helps remind meditators that the real wisdom, real panya, is when you see for yourself. When you see that this arises and ceases, this arises and ceases, the rising arises and ceases, you see impermanence, you see suffering, you see non-self, you see things just as they are. Where you no longer expect things to be stable, satisfying, controllable. You no longer have any expectations at all. You're rather just watching things change as they change. And you no longer have this need for them to be other than what they are, this wish or this wanting or desire or aversion or delusion, worry or doubt or anything like that. That's when wisdom is truly powerful, when you start to just see things as they are. And so the point is that once these five powers become strong in this way, and you're continuously mindful, there comes the moment where the mind reaches the apex of wisdom and the apex of understanding. And it has this moment where it is perfectly clear to the meditator that nothing is permanent, nothing is satisfying, nothing is controllable, meaning everything that arises is impermanent, unsatisfying, uncontrollable. In other words, not worth clinging to. So there comes the understanding that nothing is worth clinging to. Not this thing or that thing, but the appreciation through complete and perfect observation of the momentary experiences that nothing is worth clinging to. And it's that moment that leads the mind to cessation, where one enters into Nibbana and there is a break from craving, a break from clinging, a break from suffering, which leads to it. And that, of course, is the experience of enlightenment, where afterwards one is able to appreciate the difference and experience what it means to be truly at peace and free from greed, free from anger, free from delusion. So that's the five powers, an important part of our practice, important to remember, important to contemplate and consider. Mostly important to realize when we are when they are imbalanced, and as you've read in our literature on how to practice, You use mindfulness to catch the hindrances that are associated, because if you have weak confidence, then there's lots of doubt. So you don't worry about the confidence, you focus when you doubt and say, doubting, doubting. Or you have you have not enough wisdom and too much confidence, you have to catch yourself sometimes when you're greedy or when you're attached to something. There can be confidence involved there. It means you don't have you have to use wisdom to see that this is greed and so on and so on. Well, you just note the hindrance, liking or wanting or disliking. Because liking and disliking are often very much associated with confidence. You're confident that you should try and destroy something out of anger. You're confident that you should chase after something. And you step back with wisdom, or you cultivate wisdom, not through worrying about the wisdom, but by focusing on the defilements again. Concentration, when you're tired, you focus on the drowsiness. Effort, when you're restless, you focus on the restlessness. By being mindful, you balance these faculties, and it helps you sometimes to reflect, as Ananda did, and think, I have too much of one or too much of another, and to adjust your practice accordingly. Sometimes adjusting the postures, as Ananda did. As I said, if you're drowsy, you can stand up and do walking. If you're restless, you can sit down or even do lying in cases of extreme restlessness. So those are the five powers, the five powers that we focus on in Buddhism. So we call them the five powers because they are our five powers, that the five that are necessary for attaining freedom from suffering. And that's the Dhamma for today.